A Matter of Spirit is the quarterly publication of the Inner Community Peace and Justice Center.
Spring 2016. Issue on Listen, Contemplate the Sacred.
Listening at the Heart of Dialogue by William Isaacs. Excerpt taken from Dialogue and the Art of Thinking Together, Chapter 4, Listening, by William Isaacs. Reprinted with permission from the author. Isaacs is founder and president of Dialogos, a leadership consulting and strategy development firm based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He has co-founded the Organizational Learning Center at MIT and is a senior lecturer at MIT's Sloan School of Management. The heart of dialogue is a simple but profound capacity to listen. Listening requires we not only hear the words, but also embrace, accept, and gradually let go of our own inner clamoring. As we explore it, we discover that listening is an expansive activity. It gives us a way to perceive more directly the ways we participate in the world around us. This means listening not only to others, but also to ourselves and our own reactions. Recently, a manager in a program I was leading told me, "You know, I have always prepared myself to speak, but I have never prepared myself to listen." This is, I have found, a common condition. For listening, a subject we often take for granted, is actually very hard to do, and we are rarely prepared for it. To listen is to develop an inner silence. This is not a familiar habit for most of us. Emerson once joked that 95% of what goes on in our minds is none of our business. We often pay great attention to what goes on in us, when what is actually required is a kind of disciplined self-forgetting. This does not have to be difficult. It is within the reach of each of us. To do this, you do not have to retreat to a monastery or to be converted to some new belief. You do, though, have to do some deliberate work to cultivate settings inside yourself and with others where it is possible to listen. In other words, you must create a space in which listening can occur. The ways we have learned to listen, to impose or apply meaning to the world, are very much a function of our mental models, of what we hold in our minds as truths. But the physical functioning of our ears, and how they differ from other senses, can shed light on how we can learn to make sense in new ways. The sense of hearing. The sense of hearing is ever-present. Our hearing puts us on the map. It balances us. Our sense of balance is intimately tied to our hearing. Both come from the same source within our bodies. We listen in a way that tells us about the dimensionality of our world. Hearing is auditory, of course, relating to sound. The word auditory and oral have the same roots as the word audience and auditorium. Their most ancient root means to place perception. When we listen, we place our perceptions. Our culture, though, is dominated by sight. We see thousands of images flashed across our mind in an hour of television or the internet. The result of this external bombardment of visual impressions is that we tend now to think in these ways. In the Western world, we have begun to be habituated to this quick pace and are impatient with other rhythms. But seeing and listening are very different. The substance of seeing is light. Light moves at a far more rapid pace than sound, 186,000 miles per second, as opposed to 1,100 feet per second. To listen, in other words, you must slow down and operate at the speed of sound rather than at the speed of light. The eye seems to perceive at a superficial level, at the level of reflected light. While the eye sees at the surface, the ear tends to penetrate below the surface. To listen well, we must attend both to the words and the silence between the words. Listening and the principle of participation. Our capacity to listen puts us in contact with the wider dimensions of the world in which we live. It lets us connect to it. Listening can open in us a door, a greater sense of participation in the world. I see listening, properly understood and developed, as an immediate gateway that can connect us with the much-touted but much-misunderstood notion that we live in a participative universe, one of the four key principles that underlie the approach to dialogue proposed in Dialogue and the Art of Thinking Together. The principle of participation builds upon the realization that individuals are active participants in the living world, a part of nature, as well as observers of it. At the heart of the matter here is the idea that human beings participate intimately in their worlds and are not separate from them. The principle of participation that lies behind the practice of listening is well demonstrated by a hologram. A hologram is a three-dimensional image created by the interference pattern of two interacting laser beams. All the information contained on the plate is enfolded into every part of the plate. Language is holographic. Our language is also holographic. Each word contains not only the wider context of paragraph and sentence, but the deeper context of our lives. When you first interact with someone, their initial words carry the entire hologram of their consciousness to you. Every part of ourselves is enfolded in every part of our conversations, whether we realize it or not. But we cannot always tell the extent of our participation. There is not enough information to produce a clear and coherent understanding. We lack a focusing process, a way of containing the enormity in a small space. Dialogue is the focusing mechanism for the hologram of conversation. Through it, we can expand our awareness to include ever greater wholeness. Dialogue is a process that can allow us to become aware of our participation in a much wider whole. Like the telescope, it focuses the available light more completely so that we can see more. Learning to listen. Learning to listen begins with recognizing how you are listening now. Generally, we are not all that conscious of how we listen. You can begin to listen by listening first to yourself and to your own reactions. Ask yourself, "What do I feel here?" or "How does this feel?" Try to identify what you feel more carefully and directly. Beginning with the perception of your own feelings connects you to your heart and to the heart of your experience. To learn to be present, we must learn to notice what we are feeling now. Be aware of thought. As you begin to listen, you can also begin to notice what you are thinking. Focus your thoughts on someone you care about for a moment. Almost immediately, you may find that you are flooded with thoughts and images of that person. You may also experience a range of feelings. Your memory plays a very powerful force in how you perceive those around you. To listen is to realize that much of our reaction to others comes from memory. It is stored reaction, not fresh response at all. Listening from my predispositions in this way is listening from the net of thought that I cast on a particular situation. Stick to the facts. We need to learn to listen with a great deal more humility. This typically means literally coming down to earth and connecting what we think with the experiences that lead us to think it. While this may seem obvious and easy, in practice, people continually jump to conclusions, speak abstractly, and fail to notice they are doing so. A new discipline of listening to what is said can make a real change. This is not always so easy to do. We are often unaware of the extent to which we assume what we see is what is there. A colleague of mine tells the story of a man who went one day to pick up his high school-age daughter and another girl. As he drove up to the place he was to meet her, he saw her leaning on a black BMW sedan. Standing nearby were two young men, both with pagers and cell phones. One had a ponytail. This man's immediate thought, drug dealers. But he noticed how he had begun to judge them and stopped himself. He went up and started to talk to them and found that they were volunteer firemen, that the BMW was used and much older than he had realized, and that the young men were very gentle, very bright, and capable. The ladder of interference. We need to distinguish between the interferences we make about experience and the experience itself. Why is this important? One of the ways we sustain the culture of thinking alone is that we form conclusions and then do not test them, treating our initial inferences as facts. We wall ourselves off, in other words, from the roots of our own thinking. And when we are invested in an opinion, we tend to seek evidence that we are right and avoid evidence that we are wrong. Errors of this sort can have devastating consequences. Follow the disturbance. Slowing down our thinking and listening in this way is not so easy, in part because the landscape is not neutral. Some of the memories we have are painful. They move very swiftly and grab us by the scruff of the neck. By the time we realize their influence, we are caught. Often when we listen to others, we may discover that we are listening from disturbance. In other words, we are listening from an emotional memory rather than from the present moment. Listen from resistance. This relates directly to the challenge of listening beyond the net of our thought and even the disturbances we may feel. This may be better put as listen while noticing resistance. The challenge here is to become conscious of the ways in which we project our opinions about others onto them, how we color or distort what is said without realizing it. Stand still. Perhaps the simplest and most potent practice for listening is simply to be still. By being still in ourselves, quieting the inner chatter of our minds, we can open up to a way of being present and listening that cuts through everything. Think of this as calming the surface of the waters of our experience so that we can see below to the depths. To stand still is to come into contact with the wholeness that pervades everything that is already here. It is to touch the aliveness of the universe. To be lost is to lose contact with this wholeness. Listening from silence means listening for and receiving the meanings that well up from deep within us. These creative pulses may move in us, but often we are too busy to pay attention. Stand still. The art of listening together. Listening is usually considered singular activity, but in dialogue, one discovers a further dimension of listening, the ability not only to listen, but to listen together as a part of the larger whole. When people listen together, dialogue can sometimes evoke a deep and unusual experience of common understanding and communion. This is what is meant by a term coined by the early Christian communities at the beginning of the first millennium, koinonia. It means impersonal fellowship. In this state, people connect very intimately with one another, but not intrusively. Listen for the dilemmas. One of the reasons people struggle to say what they think is that they are in a dilemma. In situations like these, people typically fail to hear what the other actually intends. Often, there is a fair degree of noise in the communication. What are we to do? The challenge is to become aware of the fact that especially when we try hard to listen, we will often still have a part of us actively failing to do so. The key is to simply become aware of this, to make conscious just what we are doing. Awareness is curative. As we stand still, our listening can open us into frontiers we did not realize were there.
Be Your Best and Leave the Rest to God, by Gretchen Gundrum. Gretchen Gundrum teaches psycho-spiritual development at the School of Theology and Ministry at Seattle University. She is also a psychologist in private practice, integrating spirituality into work with her clients. The Dominicans have a saying that goes something like this: the first person who needs to be converted is the preacher. To give a good reflection on the gospel, the speaker must live the word herself, letting it permeate her heart and soul. Otherwise, her witness will be hollow, inauthentic. When asked to write about how ordinary people can be contemplative, my reaction was, I'm not the best person to be talking about contemplation. But my objections were overridden, so here we are. I am being converted. What does it mean to be contemplative? Contemplation, meditation, mindfulness, centering prayer, and gratitude practice. And gratitude practice all have one thing in common: a desire to connect to the divine. Few of us have time or patience to sit for an hour of daily meditation as religious do in monasteries and convents. But we can engage in the practice of the presence of God that Brother Lawrence exemplified 300 years ago, and that St. Therese of Lisieux worked on through her little way. In her autobiography, she admits anger when being intermittently splashed with dishwater by another novice, but converts it into silent prayer. I'm sure I'd have wanted to give that other sister at least a dirty look. Not having arrived at sainthood, some of us are clearly works in progress. Richard Rohr teaches that you cannot live in the presence of God, because God surrounds us everywhere, within, without. Our task is to become conscious of that, done best by being present to the situation in which we find ourselves. Our spiritual DNA pulses with longing to be reconnected to the source of our existence. We live in mystery, and we know we will die into it. Meanwhile, we are gifted daily by opportunities to love, be creative, and grateful for all that is, even some challenges we'd rather not be dealing with. We know that for those that love God, all things work together for good. Romans 8:28. Being in the present moment and enjoying it is both the easiest and the most difficult contemplative practice there is. Our minds ruminate on the past and fantasize about the future. We lose the present, all that we really have. What does living in the awareness of God's presence do to us and for us? It functions like a circuit breaker to get us out of the trance of our egoic patterns that keep us stuck in self-centered space. When admiring the beauty of a flower, the tiny hand of a baby with its grasping fingers and minuscule fingernails, the sun peeking out after a gray, rainy day, I find that there's no space in my psyche for anger, fear, irritation, or impatience. I must slow down to see and absorb the reality that is in front of me, God's reality. It's a reminder that I'm not in charge of the universe. I am part of something immense, something I can only hope I might one day understand. This fills me with awe. Learning to sit quietly and invite God into conversation is a wonderful practice. Pouring out our hearts, the troubles, fears, worries, joys, sorrows, pain, and hopes that are a part of human life, keeps us grounded and connected to our source. I've never considered myself a great mediator. My monkey mind, as the Buddhists call it, is always overactive, and I worry that I'm not doing it right. To let go of feeling that one has to achieve something is important. Willingness to take time to connect to God, to keep coming back to focus on the breath and the word or mantra that keeps me out of my head, is key. Spending 10 or 20 minutes several times a week, sitting in silence, allows God to do sweet and gentle work on the soul and the spirit. I receive greater clarity about my life and more space to be compassionate to myself and others. I just have to get out of my own way and let God be God. There are many ways of entering into contemplative practice. Introverts and extroverts will have different preferences. Introverts might find a sitting practice the most helpful. Listening to music, lighting a candle, doing lectino or viso divina, and reflecting in a quiet space in one's own home can provide moments of enriched stillness. Classic lectio divina involves the use of scripture to prime one's own consciousness. Visio divina uses pictures, paintings, or photographs as centering tools. Pictures may be of Jesus, Mary, or the saints, or they might be a beautiful photograph of nature. Extroverts might prefer a walking meditation, in nature or walking a labyrinth. Journaling, gardening, playing a musical instrument, drawing, singing, painting, or dancing are also means of entering into sacred space. Adult coloring books are being espoused as a way of centering. When he was a medic in World War I, C.G. Jung grew a mandala every morning as a way of grounding himself in preparation to face the suffering of the day. And let's not leave out our pets. Walking with them, stroking them, and communing with them can also be a way of connecting to the source, not to mention lowering one's blood pressure. The work of sanctification is God's. Our role is to be open and ready. Thomas Merton once said, "It is the will to pray that is the essence of prayer, and the desire to find God, and to seek God, and to love God, is the one thing that matters." We don't have to be perfect contemplatives, because we can't. We only have to do our best and leave the rest to God.
Listening to Become a Church of Mercy by John Whitney, S.J., pastor of St. Joseph Church, Seattle, and a former provincial of the Oregon province of the Society of Jesus. Sitting beside Maggie's bed, I could see what the last few days had done to her, how it had worn her down and taken from her the small reserves of strength she had managed to retain. Now she was barely able to sit up, and the rasp of fluid could be heard in her throat as she breathed, with the aid of oxygen, through the small opening in her neck. In her eyes there was just an ember of the life that had been there only a few days before, and, though she could not speak, I knew the thought that sat behind the small smile she turned to me. "Well, that was close," it said, "but there won't be many more." Holding her hand, I looked back at her without tears and with the same resigned smile said simply, "I know. I know. I know." Past fear or hope, past forgiveness or regret, past consolation or despair, we sat together in that moment as one heart, attuned to each other, listening to each other, held in communion through the mercy of God. Such a moment of grace, so common and yet so extraordinary, offers an insight into the true meaning of God's mercy and into the great hope offered to the Church in this Jubilee year of mercy. For mercy is more than forgiveness, more than a simple remission of sins or the letting go of past injuries. Rather, mercy is presence and embrace. It is opening one's heart to wretchedness and holding the other in communion, even at the risk of pain. Mercy is indeed the way God forgives us, but it also transcends mere forgiveness. For unlike justice, which applies law, or forgiveness, which mitigates its transgression, mercy involves communion between persons and the reconciliation of broken hearts. It is God reaching out to us with love and becoming one with us in our struggles. God drawing us into the divine life through an engagement that reaches its fullness in the incarnation. Mercy is the Spirit, spoken over the waters, that brings forth life. It is the Father, hearing the cries of the Hebrew children and calling Moses to set them free. It is Jesus speaking with the Samaritan woman and liberating her from loneliness, allowing her to proclaim with joy, "He told me everything I have done." Mercy is God listening to the world with compassion and speaking a covenant of love into the heart of every woman and man willing to listen. Yet, if the mercy of God is about personal encounter and not simply about abstract structures of justice or ritual remission of sins, then the Jubilee year of mercy must be about encounter as well, and not simply about social remedies or personal penances. It must be about speaking and listening, about discerning God in the other, and about listening to God in oneself. It must be concerned with the reality of the Spirit incarnated not just in Catholics, but in all people of the world. In the poor Syrian grandmother who cannot feed the children left into her care. In the undocumented Salvadoran detained and facing deportation back to his gang-held village. In the Brazilian wife whose Zika virus puts the child she carries at risk. And in the young African-American teenager filled with rage at the death of so many peers. The Jubilee of Mercy summons us to listen to the voices of individual women and men and treat them not as categories to be sorted nor as problems to be solved, but as beloved brothers and sisters, unique expressions of God, worthy of our time and attention. As Pope Francis might say, a year of mercy must be a year about reality and not simply about ideas. And no one demonstrates what this Jubilee year of mercy can be more than that Francis himself. Whether standing in the mud of the Central African Republic, where he opened the Jubilee doors a week before they were opened in Rome, or sitting in a mosque with leaders of the Muslim community, where he spoke of mutual respect and understanding, whether traveling to Cuba to meet for the first time in history with the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, or kneeling in the midst of a Mexican hospital as poor children sang Ave Maria for him, whether reminding the bishops of the Synod on the family, the Church's first duty is not to hand down condemnations or anathemas, but to proclaim God's mercy, or asking forgiveness of other Christian communities for sins committed by the Catholic Church against them. Francis has borne witness to mercy that embraces and listens, that challenges even as it brings closer. Shying away from doctrinal abstractions, he has waded into the world in all its brokenness, offering himself as a catalyst for mercy, a listener for those who need to speak, a speaker for those who have been silenced, a presence to those for whom words have grown empty, being so often broken. If we as church are to be taken seriously this Jubilee year of mercy, we must become at every level what Francis invites us by example to be. We must wade into the world in all its complexity and woundedness. We must listen actively and humbly, especially to voices so often excluded from our dialogues, to women and racial minorities, refugees and migrants, indigenous peoples, and the LGBT community. We must practice the works of mercy, not as patrons, but as partners, not simply as duties of justice, but as part of our communion with every woman and man. This is the mercy of God, the mercy planted in each human heart.
Interfaith Dialogue by Mary Kay Kantz and Mohammed Samara. Mary Kay Kantz is a former member of the faculty of the Case Western Reserve University School of Law. She is retired and lives with her husband in Greenville, South Carolina. Mohammed Samara is a computer scientist and a graduate of Florida Institute of Technology. He lives in Melbourne Beach with his wife, Tammy, and two daughters and two sons. He is blessed with a baby daughter named Bindi. Gathered around benches near the river, we were enjoying Esau's pasta and homemade garlic bread, chatting and laughing together. We were young and old, black and white, healthy and not, some owning comfortable beds, some living in the woods, Muslim, Christian, and Jew. Project Downtown, a ministry that calls for taking time to engage in conversation with hungry folks on the street while sharing a meal, was the brainchild of Muslim students at Florida universities. Our own Project Downtown group had its roots in the counterculture journeys begun a year earlier by 18 Muslims and Christians in Milburn, Florida. News reports of a shooting at a local mosque and anti-Muslim speakers on the luncheon circuit led members of the Just Faith community at a Catholic parish to ask an imam if he would connect us with some Muslims who might be interested in interfaith dialogue. The idea of Muslims and Christians sitting down together can raise antagonism and apprehension, even within faith communities. As the Just Faith group began promoting the idea of interfaith dialogue, some parishioners echoed the too common media-inspired fear and anger toward Islam. We learned that a public invitation can, unfortunately, draw people who are more interested in confrontation than in sharing and learning. There was also some hesitation and fear within the Muslim community. When members of your faith are being physically or verbally attacked out of ignorance and hatred, you might well have some concern about agreeing to engage with a room full of strangers. So we found it best to start out small. By extending personal invitations to some we knew would be open to the experience, we created a space for respectful listening. Intentions are the vehicle to new destinations. Unity of intention is essential to establishing trust in the process and in each other. Having some format or process to start with can help get things going. We used Just Faith Ministries' 8-week program, The Sultan and the Saint, written for just such a group. Any process, of course, calls for honest communication and a willingness to be flexible and responsive to each group's needs. Then the dialogue becomes your own. At our first gathering, conversation was stilted, and folks shifted a bit uncomfortably in their chairs until we took a break for refreshments. Within minutes, we found ourselves in lively little groups, each one including both Catholics and Muslims. We instinctively recognized that we were there to become friends, not simply to study each other. Whether over shortbread and lemonade or goat stew and hot tea, our mid-session breaks became a key to our success, spilling over into light, cheerful discussions and leading us to plan picnics and parties at other times, too. As in any relationship, members of the group have been able to talk freely and listen uncritically with open ears and hearts. Being ready to discover friendship, being flexible enough to let conversations move along naturally, led us to a point of sharing personal stories and asking whatever questions any of us had about the other's faith. The experience was life-changing. Transformation came about because we resolved that every participant had to be committed to heartfelt listening. There was to be no preaching, no proselytizing, no denigrating the other faith. Rather, we were all invited to listen with fully open minds for similarities between the faiths, as well as significant differences, for places where all find God in their lives, for the way to a spirit of companionship on the faith journey. We were all surprised by the similarities we found between Islam and Christianity, and we were enlightened and inspired by our visits to each other's places of worship, Friday for Jumu'ah prayer, Sunday for Mass. One of the major similarities between Islam and Christianity is the command to love God and to love and serve our brothers and sisters in this world. We are called to imitate the prophets, to follow in the footsteps of Jesus and Muhammad, peace be upon both of them. As we learned about each other's faiths, we looked ahead to engaging in a justice project, especially one that would help us continue to be in contact with each other when our initial commitment to the dialogue group ended. Accordingly, our Project Downtown group was born. The Quran says, O mankind, we created you from a single pair of a male and a female, and made you into nations and tribes, that ye may know each other, not that ye may despise each other. Verily, the most honored of you in the sight of Allah is he who is the most righteous of you. 49:13. Our story is worth sharing because it highlights everything good about the human race. Strangers came together for the first time, had a conversation, and then realized we are one tribe. In the second meeting, we became friends. A few months into it, we became champions for one another. Our story illustrates the power of listening, rooted in curiosity, to know others. Story: Table Fellowship. During football playoffs, I was at a local brewery to watch the game with some friends. I noticed a middle-aged white gentleman reading a book on science and religion. My interest was piqued. I overheard a conversation he was having with the person next to him on creation, so I assumed he was an evangelical. As a Catholic and a lesbian, my prejudgments and fears were at the surface, yet I felt compelled to enter into dialogue with this man. I am not sure how I overcame my fear, other than I had been craving to get outside of my box and encounter someone with a vastly different view. I wanted to walk in someone else's shoes and enter into another's faith experience to gain patience and understanding. I engaged him about the book, faith, science, and biblical interpretation. It was a great conversation, but when he invited me to go to his church with him, a small sense of fear and anxiety overcame me. Do I go? Do I ask the question? With a deep breath, I asked if I joined him, would I be accepted by his church as a gay woman? He seemed to struggle, but spoke with compassion and then challenged me biblically. I challenged him from my theological perspective and my experience of love and grace. We genuinely listened, empathized, and grappled with what each other was presenting. I cannot speak for him, but I know I walked away with a sense that as much as I wanted to be embraced as a human worthy of table fellowship, I needed to view him in that way too. He did not change my faith, as I am sure that I did not change his faith and how he interprets the Bible. But we truly encountered each other and saw each other as brothers and sisters in Christ. Teresa Lukasik currently works at the Ignatian Spirituality Center as their Ignite Coordinator, Ignatian Spirituality for Young Adults. She received her MA in Spirituality from Loyola University of Chicago.
Listening to Earth, a Contemplative Response by Sharon Zayek. Sharon Zayek is director of Jubilee Farm, her congregation's 164-acre center for ecology and spirituality. She has a master's in earth literacy from St. Mary of the Woods College in Indiana and is available for programs and retreats. Listen to Earth, What does that mean? Why should we even take the time to listen? How do we listen? Particularly when more and more of us are living in the world of virtual reality. How do we hear Earth cry when she doesn't text us? Once upon a time, an article with this title would have evoked from me a description of the many facets of Earth that have filled me with profound awe, deep gratitude, and intense desire to be more and do more and take in more. That all remains true, but it is more than that. We know now that listening to Earth is much more than that. Indeed, simply by virtue of what we are, our listening is more an act of being rather than doing. It was winter of 1999. The four of us, well bundled against the cold, walked the pasture areas of the farm, just bursting with the knowledge that this land would become ours to explore, to nurture and to share with all the guests that would follow us from the retreat center we currently operated on the other side of the city. We came filled with excitement of our vision to build a small retreat center and make what was to become Jubilee Farm the go-to place for retreat, recreation, and all things sustainable. In less than 15 minutes, we knew that was not what the land asked from us. The message was subtle and very clear. No words, no thoughts, not even a definable feeling. Just a deep, abiding knowing that we were not to violate the integrity of the land with septic systems, bulldozers, and paved drives. Our presence here must be in concert with all the land offered us and those who would come after us. Quickly letting go of the buildings we had envisioned, we still moved forward full steam with constructing our first 10-year plan. We carefully laid out what we would do each of the next 10 years to create a model of ecology center. We soon learned that things do not happen in the linear progression of human planning, but in cyclic, rhythmic, organic patterns. Most of the activities we stretched out over 10 years were in motion within the first three. And Earth has continued to teach us that what needs to happen here will happen in its own time. All of us have experienced some incredible beauty that forever marks our souls. Sunbeams, passing clouds, mountains, a waft of fresh air, moonlight in a puddle of water, a single blade of grass growing out of a crack in a battered sidewalk, another's kindness. Earth constantly begs our attention. She is ever present to us, assuring us we belong, that we are part of the greater community of life. She is not separate from us. She is one with us. In fact, we are Earth in her human expression, formed from her, holding all her elements in our uniquely human mode. It is our relationship with her that makes us human, just as the relationship of whale to Earth makes whale. By virtue of what we are, we cannot but help hear Earth speak. One with her, our voice is Earth's voice, one of her many voices. When we listen to any part of her, we hear our greater self. When we speak, we are Earth's expression. We are Earth expressing that part of herself, and she counts on our voice more than ever. Earth's collective voice is adamant, persistent, and increasingly urgent. Her cries, our cries, fill our internet and television screens and make tragic covers on our magazines, demanding our attention again and again and again. We, together with the greater community of life that is Earth, are embroiled in a conflagration of crisis that is undoing the web of relationships that has existed for millions of years. We do hear Earth's cries. They are our own. The challenge is how we, individually and corporately, plan to respond. Melting glaciers, rising sea levels, and the loss of countless species and ecosystems are now beyond our response. Curbing excessive waste and obscene pollution, eliminating fossil fuel emissions, and meeting head-on the massive migrations of peoples are not. Our response requires the human family to pull together on a scale never before imagined. And as Pope Francis repeatedly exhorts us, it demands dialogue with all the affected parties. Listening to Earth means we listen to one another, and not just those with whom we agree, or who support our thinking, or those who stretch our thinking, but are still safe. We must listen even to those who seem at total odds with everything we believe. We must listen to what is being said underneath all the rhetoric. All of us are part of the one same cosmic whole. On this grander scale, we are the universe and human form. There is no we and they, except in our unique expressions of as universe. Each and every voice is part of the greater whole. That brings us back to the earlier questions about listening to Earth. How do we listen to other humans who don't speak as we do or who don't share our ideals? And how do we hear all those whose voice and how do we hear all those whose voices, human and other than human, are discounted or brutally silenced? Simply, and yet not so simply, we must want to. We must command the discipline that attentive listening requires of us. That is, the doing of listening, the being of listening, comes with knowing that we are one with the greater whole and that the many voices of Earth are really our own.
A Matter of Spirit is a publication of the Inner Community Peace and Justice Center. Sponsoring communities include Adrian Dominican Sisters, Congregation of the Sisters of St. Joseph of Peace, Oregon Province Jesuits, Sisters of the Holy Names of Jesus and Mary, U.S. Ontario Province, Sisters of Providence Mother Joseph Province, Sisters of St. Francis of Philadelphia, and Tacoma Dominicans. Affiliate communities include Benedictine Sisters of Cottonwood, Idaho, Benedictine Sisters of Lacey, Benedictine Sisters of Mount Angel, Dominican Sisters of Mission San Jose, Dominican Sisters of San Rafael, Sinsinawa Dominicans, Sisters of Charity of the Blessed Virgin Mary, Sisters of St. Francis of Redwood City, Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, Sisters of St. Mary of Oregon, Society of the Holy Child Jesus, Society of the Sacred Heart, and Ursuline Sisters of the Roman Union. Our editorial board for this issue was Timneet Gourmet, Gretchen Gundrum, Linda Haydock, SNJM, Vince Herberholt, Tom Holscher, Nick Melee, and Janet Quillian. Our editor for the print edition was Elizabeth Murphy, and layout of the print edition was done by Shannon Hargis. For more information, visit our website at www.ipjc.org.